This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Doors, with lead singer Jim Morrison, formed in 1965. By 1966, they were playing L.A.'s Whiskey A Go-Go next to Van Morrison and about to go big, huge. By 1971, Morrison was dead at 27. The Doors took their name from Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception and the William Blake line of poetry, "If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite." Cultural critic Grill Marcus was listening then, and he's listening now. This hour on Point, Grill Marcus and The Doors. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in the music of The Doors? Sounds of yesterday, of today, sounds of dread, of light? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Grill Marcus, legendary music journalist and cultural critic. He made his name in 1975 with the book Mystery Train that put rock and roll in the context of American archetypes from Moby Dick to the Great Gatsby. He's written memorably on Bob Dylan, Elvis Presley, Van Morrison, and much more. His new book is The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to Five Mean Years. Grill Marcus, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you with us.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
You've written about American prophecy in music. We talked with you about Van Morrison, his music and life. What's taken you, Grill, back to The Doors?
You know, I never planned to write this book, but for years, over the last 3 years, I found myself driving into San Francisco from Berkeley once or twice a week. And every time, 20 minutes over, 25 minutes back. You know, in 2010 or this year too, I'd be hearing Lady Gaga, Bad Romance. I'd be hearing Train, Hey Soul Sister.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, repeated over and over again. I loved both of those records. But I also found, switching stations from one to the other, in that 45, 50 minutes, I would hear The Doors. I would hear them, you know, not just once, sometimes three, four times, and not just light my fire, but maybe a dozen different songs. They were all over the place, and they sounded great. And often, you know, the songs like L.A. Woman, Roadhouse Blues, I'd always liked them, but I'd never realized they were so big. They were just so expansive and funny and not giving a damn about anything except going from one place to another. And I just thought, well, I can write about this stuff. I've got to do this.
And you remind us that with The Doors, I mean, so many artists of that generation, musicians of that generation and groups have been reduced to kind of one song that keeps getting rolled out on the radio now. Dylan, Like a Rolling Stone, Rolling Stones, Gimme Shelter, or, you know, Satisfaction, The Byrds, Mr. Tambourine Man, Wilson Pickett in the Midnight Hour, and on down. They get reduced. But The Doors, they've got a playlist that's broad and keeps coming back. And yet, I wonder, just put side by side for us a second. You mentioned Lady Gaga's Bad Romance, Train, Hey Soul Sister. And then you come to The Doors, and there's a different tone and texture to it. Meditate on that for a second. The sound of pop music now and the sound of what The Doors are doing or did.
You know, I tried, as I spent a year listening to all of their records and lots of stuff that had never been released at the time, and this marvelous 4-CD collection of bootleg recordings from the beginning of their career right to the and really awful, terrible audience recordings, you know, where you can barely hear, but it kind of generates its own faraway allure. And as I listened to this stuff, I thought, well, what's this about? You know, what drew people to this band at the time, and what draws people to them now? And you know, there was just a refusal of happy endings. There was a seriousness of intent, not, oh, we're serious musicians, we're going to make great music, but more like, these are serious times, terrible things are happening, and we can't pretend that isn't so. And that sense of taking their moment for what it was, and not trying to escape from it, not trying to minimize it, not trying to prettify it, which so many other people did, and not trying to turn it into melodrama either. That, to me, was what was really at the heart of so many of their songs, the songs that were glorious, the songs that failed. There was this attempt to say, this is trouble, this is bad.
We're talking 67, 68, 1969, yeah. 1970, right on through a tough stretch of years.
You know, that's a time when a song like Take It As It Comes, you might reply, not me, you know. Mm-hmm. Take the assassination of Martin Luther King, of Bobby Kennedy, take riots cracking the country in half, take the Vietnam War as it comes. What does that mean? And what it means is something you have to figure out for yourself, but in the music. And this is a book about listening. This mm-hmm. is not some grand philosophical statement. It's just sitting down and listening to the songs and trying to get lost in them, and then come out and say, well, this is what I found when I came out of the cave of this song. In this music is a sense of dread, a sense that things are not going to work out well, that we're not going to like what we see in the newspaper when we wake up, not tomorrow, but 5, 10 years from now. Life is serious business, and it doesn't pay off the way you want it to. And that's, you know, that's not an argument. Mm-hmm. That's an impulse that mm-hmm. they follow.
You listened to them in those years, and I want to hear about that. The whole country listened to them. Of course, go back right here. We've got some tape from this is the Ed Sullivan Show, 1967. You could set this up for us a little, Grill. They had kind of an argument with Sullivan before the show about what they were going to sing on the air. He didn't want them to sing the word, this is in Light My Fire. He didn't want them to sing the word higher. Fat chance they wouldn't sing that. They wanted to say better, but higher came out, as you remind us, Grill.
Well, they had agreed. They had agreed with Ed Sullivan, okay, no problem, Ed.
Because it had a drug implication, I presume, is why he thought what he thought and why he didn't want it.
Well, sure. But, you know, the Rolling Stones had been on the show earlier in the year, and the show insisted they change Let's Spend the Night Together to Let's Spend Some Time Together. Yeah. And you can watch that now, and you see Mick Jagger and Keith Richards very, very insistently saying, let's spend some time together. Mm. You know, they're really
– take that
They're not making any – they're not going to slip up on that one at all. So the Doors made the same promise. And, you know, supposedly John Densmore, the drummer, Robbie Krieger, the guitar player, and Ray Manzarek, the organ player, said, yeah – you know, if we go along with this, we're going to be on the show a lot. It's going to be huge for us. If it was good enough for the Stones, you know, it's mm-hmm. good enough for us. It's kind of hard to believe that they didn't figure, if not know, that Jim Morrison was not going to play along. And you know, it's a marvelous performance, because the first time he gets to the word higher, where it's supposed to be better. The word just kind of barely sneaks out, part of the first syllable. And the second time, you know, it's as if he's coming out with guns drawn.
Let's listen. Ed Sullivan Show, 1967. The Doors, Light My Fire.
Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night off. Be your
it is. There's The Higher, there's The Fire, Jim Morrison on Ed Sullivan, 1967. What did the country make of that in 1967, Greil? Was that just the sound of the 60s and, you know, families on their sofas rocking along with The Doors?
Oh, nobody made anything of it. Nobody was shocked. Nobody was scared. Nobody was upset. This was a completely phony controversy. The country didn't need to be protected from a word. It didn't want to be protected. What came off that night was, a pretty limitless performance by Jim Morrison. Sometimes, you know, he's a great crooner. He was a great soft singer. He was a great Bing Crosby. He was a great Frank Sinatra. But sometimes, he was a good blues singer too, and his voice would tear. And you'd have a sense, this is an ordinary person trying to get something across. This is not an artist. This is not a professional. And that's what he sounds like there.
Greil Marcus, stand by. The new book is The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to 5 Mean Years. We're going to dig right on in with the wonderful Greil Marcus. Listeners, you can join us. Do you still feel the magic, the menace, the dread of The Doors? What do they stand for to you? Jim Morrison, Light My Fire, Riders on the Storm, more. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with music journalist and cultural critic Greil Marcus about the dark charisma of rock and roll's The Doors. He has written about listening to them again in his new book, The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to 5 Mean Years. 5 years between the time they really hit the scene and the July 3rd, 1971 death of 27-year-old lead singer Jim Morrison. You can join the conversation this hour. How do The Doors sound to you today? Does their sound speak to this moment? Is it an antique? Why do we keep coming back to their story, their allure? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Greil Marcus joins us from New York. Jim, we've got a lot of callers here. Here's Greil. We've got a Jim calling in from Hawaii, from Waikoloa, Hawaii. Hawaiian Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Greil Marcus.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a musician here. I play up and down the coastline here on the Kona Coast, and it never fails, like, when I'll add or play a Doors song, and, people just come up to you, and they sort of gravitate toward you, and, like, they have these wonderful stories that they'll sort of, like, you know, when you're a musician and you're playing these kind of these gigs and you add, you know, your cover song sort of a reflection of, you know, your taste, your musical taste.
Yeah.
And, it never fails how many people come up and they'll start telling me these stories about when they lived in L.A. or, like, something that it just never fails, like the Doors and what it means to them.
Is it nostalgia, Jim, or is there something alive to them still in the Doors? Is it just tripping back to the 60s or something working for them that night as you're playing?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, a lot of it's nostalgia. A lot of it's sort of, kind of like old hippies sort of saying, hey, man, I remember seeing the Doors, and I've gotten it quite a bit. A lot of people come out from L.A. to hear, but, yeah, they're just really great stories. I mean, I always love playing it. The music is, to me, it's timeless. It's just a wonderful, It was a wonderful band, and it is a bit dark, and that's what I think I like about it. And I think that's the other interesting thing is you meet some, you know, people are, when you play a Doors song, they kind of gravitate towards the dark side.
Yeah, Jim, keep playing, and I appreciate your call from Hawaii. Grill Marcus, you've got a famous kind of famously sort of prickly attitude towards 60s nostalgia, but not what mattered about the 60s. I mean, what do you think about the durability of this group? Why are so many of their songs still on the radio playlist? What is it that keeps them coming up to Jim there in Hawaii when he covers their tunes?
Well, you know, it's not a bunch of old hippies calling up half a dozen different radio stations in the Bay Area every day demanding to hear the Doors.
Yeah.
It's clearly people a generation younger, maybe two generations younger who were connecting with this. Maybe they carry one song around with them in their heads. Maybe it's a dozen. Maybe it's simply a response and not caring at all when this music was made, you know, what the world was like when it was made, not caring at all, but hearing something that just shoots out and says, yeah, this is right. This sounds right. This is taking me somewhere that I haven't been before. So there's no way that this is just a bunch of people reliving their youth. And, you know, the Doors were not a hippie band.
Mm-hmm.
They were not nice. That's why they weren't at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. That's probably why they weren't at Woodstock in 1969, because they just didn't fit. There's a wonderful moment at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, the first real pop festival, and here's Otis Redding, and he's saying, hey, this is the love crowd, right?
Yeah,
and everybody's
yeah.
cheering, yeah, we're the love crowd. Well, the Doors were not the love crowd.
Let's hear that, if we may, Grill. We've got L.A. Woman here. This is 1971. This is recorded just 3 months before Jim Morrison's death, served as a title track to that 71 album. The first and only one not produced by Paul Rothchild. But in this recording, you can hear the kind of freedom that their new producer, Bruce Botnick, brought to things. Grill Marcus listens, and he's thinking a little Thomas Pynchon. We'll talk about it. L.A. Woman, 1971.
I see your hair is burning. Hills are filled with fire. If they say I never loved you, you know they are a liar.
Saw a woman so alone. Grill Marcus says the Doors were not nice, not the love crowd. Grill, what are you hearing?
Well, you know, there's such a great sense of discovery and fun and not giving a damn, and just a little bit of that very long recording that we just heard. If this wasn't made up on the spot right in the studio, it has exactly that feeling. And not only that, here they are in the studio, and it sounds as if Jim Morrison just walked in from the restroom, and the other guys were already playing, and he just steps into this song and begins to paint this picture of Los Angeles in the dead of night. There's something really scummy about it. There's something, you know, somebody with clothes that he hasn't changed for 3 days walking down the street, looking up at the neon, and thinking, yeah, this is where I belong. This is the right place for me. Doesn't mean it's a good place. Doesn't mean it's a bad place. It's just that sense of not caring. And, you know, to create art, you have to not care in a lot of ways. You have to forget about, is this going to be good for people? Is this going to improve society? Is this going to make me look good? Is this going to, you know, add to my earning power 5 years down the road? You have to put those kind of things out of your mind, and you can hear that freedom in this recording.
Almost a kind of L.A. street scat there. It made you think of Thomas Pynchon. Tell us.
Well, you know, I love Thomas Pynchon's detective novel, Inherent Vice. It came out in 2009. I think I've read it 4 or 5 times. I love rereading books, particularly detective stories.
Which is set back then, that L.A.
Yeah, it's set right in 1970, right about the time that the Doors are recording this song. And it's about a world that's just about to disappear. It is about, you know, a wave of the 60s cresting. And when that wave pulls back, it's going to leave a whole lot of people stranded with no idea of how to live. And, you know, there's a great sense of freedom in Pynchon's book and a great sense of impending loss. And you can hear the same thing in L.A. Woman.
Stranded and, because the dream didn't work out.
Or it just dropped dead.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that moves all through Inherent Vice, Pynchon's book, is the Manson trial. It's just about to begin, and there's this specter over L.A. And that same thing is in L.A. Woman. There's a deeper sense of jeopardy, I think, in the Pynchon book than there is in L.A. Woman. L.A. Woman is, you know, it's like Dead Man's Curve, except the race is not the Jaguar, the XKE and the Stingray. It's an old Ford trying to outrun time. That's what's going on in L.A. Woman.
I have plenty of jeopardy there. Just turn it just a little. Denny in Woodbury, Connecticut. You're on the air with Greil Marcus. Thanks for calling, Denny.
Yeah, I was a medic in 68 and 9 in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And that's where I ran into the Doors and Morrison. And, you know, the music was so dark that it seemed about the only music that we could relate to in many ways. There were other favorite groups, but, you know, this was like a theme song for us. I mean,
your soundtrack in the war zone.
Yeah, it was. It was. And, I mean, I, you know, the comments of your author there, and, you know, I was one of those people who got lost, you know, when the 60s fell apart after I came back. And finally, you know, make my way through life, I had to put Jim Morrison away. I've got every record that, you know, was ever, not the underground stuff, but, and I put it together, an intricate soundtrack. I could drive from Chicago to Los Angeles just on the Doors, but finally had to put it away. I don't listen to it anymore.
You had to put it away to put away that darkness, that strandedness.
Yeah, yeah. It's just it's he was, you know, like a reincarnation of Poe, and although we live with the yin and the yang all the time,
yeah,
the dark side's with us. But you just, you know, he gave the music, he gave the face, he gave the words, and he reveled in it at the cost of his life, you know.
Yeah. Denny, I appreciate your call. Greil Marcus, there's Denny, you know, he had to put it away to move on. But what was at the end of that road? We know what was there for Morrison. Death in Paris is buried there. But what culturally, what was at the end of that road?
Well, that's an extraordinarily moving story, and it's his story. But I can't believe it isn't the story of many other people, and it's a testament to how strong and how demanding this music is, that it makes demands on you and it can stand up to too many situations. And the fact that you have to stop listening to something, or you have to stop reading something, stop looking at a certain painting, because it's not going to help. It's going to make things worse. It's going to keep you trapped. That's a testament to the work, and that's all I can say about that.
Let's listen to more. Denny, I appreciate that. That call very much here. 1967, The Doors, The Crystal Ship.
Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have a another kiss, another flashing chance at bliss, another kiss, another kiss.
Crystal Ship, and boy, is that there. Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss. Kirsten in Boston. Kirsten, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a comment. When I was in high school in the late 90s, the Doors really spoke to me because I felt as though Jim Morrison was speaking from conflict. I think he was writing his poetry and his songs from conflicts within, conflicts in the band, conflicts in society, in politics, and that really spoke to me because being an adolescent, growing up, I had my own conflicts. So listening to that music, be it dark and dreary, really spoke to me. I really appreciated it.
It gave you company. Have you put it away, like our caller Dennis, to move beyond that, or does it still give you company?
I was going to say that. I have not put it away. I guess I don't have a story as dark as his, so I don't really need to put it away, but I still listen to it on occasion, and I too have every album. I read lots of his books, I read his poems, and I appreciated every word of it.
Kirsten, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much for that, and let me get one more. Charleston, South Carolina. Joe, you're on.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay, what do you hear?
Hey, I just wanted to say, I do like a lot of things that he was talking about, the Doors. I think that the biggest thing about the Doors, I remember being a teenager back in the 60s, was you just knew that it's not a manufactured, I don't, nothing against Lady Gaga or anything, but it's just not manufactured. They just didn't, you know, they just didn't care. They were just going to play their music, whether someone liked it or not. And I too think that, hey, you could release some of those songs, and these kids, if they didn't know any better, would just fall in love with that music. They would just follow it.
Greil Marcus says they do. He hears it on the radio even now on his drive. Joy, I appreciate your call. Greil, what about it? That, I mean, Lady Gaga, fantastically creative in her way, but Joe listens and he hears something manufactured in her that he doesn't hear there. What do you say, Greil?
Well, you know, a record like Bad Romance is not something that's just banged out in the studio by four or five people. It is an enormous production. It's like going to Radio City to see the Rockettes, except you're not seeing it, you're hearing it. But if it's manufactured, it's manufactured by her. You know, this is her vision. This is her pursuit, her flight. So, you know, I don't hear a question of this is real and this isn't. But, you know, it's kind of hard for me to respond because while the last two callers were talking, I couldn't help but listen as hard as I could to the Crystal Ship in the background, in the deep background. Mm-hmm. That is such a gorgeous song, and it's so made out of restraint. You know, you can hear both Jim Morrison and Robbie Krieger and John Densmore and Raymond Zarek waiting behind the song, waiting behind the notes, waiting behind the words.
Mm-hmm. Between They're death and dreaming this, there somewhere.
Let this move out ahead of them like a curl of smoke from a cigarette, and they're going to watch it as they're following it. And it creates a sense of suspension that's really not like anything else I know. I remember hearing this song in Germany in 1967 on Armed Forces Radio at the top of a mountain and thinking, okay, we don't even need to come down, you know?
We'll stay right
here. You're never going to hear anything more perfect than this.
Greil Marcus, stand by. The new book is The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to Five Mean Years. We'll go out of this segment with Mystery Train, live in Pittsburgh, 1970. You can join us, 800-423-8255. This is On Point.
16 coaches long. Train a ride. 16 coaches long. Will there be no train? Took my baby, he's gone. Train, train, go.
Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with music journalist, cultural critic Greil Marcus about the dark charisma of rock and roll's The Doors. Behind us right there, The Doors, 1967. This is Take It As It Comes from their first self-titled album, sort of drifting between traditional rock and roll and what will become the emblematic Doors sound. Greil Marcus' new book is The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to Five Mean Years. And nobody listens quite like him, but maybe you've listened a lot to this band. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Greil Marcus joins us from New York. We went out of that last segment with Mystery Train. And Greil, you write movingly about Elvis Presley. Of course, that was his song. And of course, he, like Jim Morrison, was this beautiful, charismatic man. But he came to take Mystery Train apart, you write. To wreck it, you write, Greil.
That's what it sounds like to me. Here's this song, and in Elvis's version, it's spare, it's simple, and yet the story it's telling is otherworldly, and there's something uncanny moving through this very clean, very straightforward music. So, you know, it's really recording, not like anything else. And when Jim Morrison takes this up, it's almost as if this is something that's got to be wrecked. This is a train that's got to be taken off the tracks. And I don't know what the reasons for that are. I can only hear what I hear and try and dramatize that for a reader. But
he was obsessed with Elvis himself, you write. I mean, Elvis's Greek god looks, his seductive vampire's hooded eyes. Like Elvis, he communicated disdain of the beautiful and the ordinary world, but then here he comes to Elvis's Mystery Train. Make it an object of disdain.
Yeah, you know, all through Jim Morrison's music, and certainly more than that of the band itself, there is this sense of loathing. And it's unstable. It's self-loathing. It's loathing of the songs he has to sing. It's loathing of the audience. It's loathing for the world as it is, even as it might be. And sometimes this comes out, and it comes out as a great smear. And it can suck you into one person's confusion and torment. And that, you know, that itself can create something enormously powerful and scary too. You know, Denny was talking earlier mm-hmm. about something he just had to put away. Mm-hmm. There's a way in which Jim Morrison too had to put these songs away, even as he sang them.
Put himself away. Finally, I mean, 1970. Here's an interview with on the CBC. Something to Say. Jim Morrison tells interviewer here Tony Thomas that he was dismayed by the world's state of affairs, from politics in Vietnam to changes in technology.
To me, there's something incredibly sad about the spectacle of millions and millions of people sitting in movie theaters and in front of television sets every night watching a second or third-hand reproduction of reality when the real world is right there in their living room or right outside in the street or down the block somewhere.
The voice of Jim Morrison, 1970. Let's go straight to Jim Morrison, the singer. This is in August 1968 at the Singer Bowl in Queens, New York. Bootleg recording here of The End.
Hey, I'm getting out. I can't take it. Look out, there's somebody coming. There's nothing you can do about it.
You're a king.
You're a king.
You're lost.
The killer awoke before dawn. He put his boots on. He took a face from the ancient gallery and he walked on down the hallway, baby.
Jim Morrison, 1968, in The End. Greil, you write movingly about The End. Speak to us about this song, this performance.
On the Doors first album, when you got to that last track. You know, you hadn't heard the record before. You didn't really know what was going on. You were excited by what you heard. You're already picking a favorite song. And then you get to this last track, and right from the first notes, you kind of know this is going to take a long time, and you know that the stakes have been raised. And there are things about the Doors that are ludicrous and almost self-parodying, but it has a power. It has an openness, a sense of freedom and experimentation that in a lot of ways is what their music always reached for. And just at the little part that we heard, you can hear Jim Morrison saying, you know, we've got to get out, got to get out of here. He's telling a little story that was never in the recorded version of the song, this little film noir scenario that just occurs to him. But what we're listening to is 1968. This song has only been out in the world a little more than a year. And already it's become this enormous cliche. And you can hear the people in the audience. What we're not hearing is right around where whoever was recording this thing in the middle of the crowd, there is just a small group of people who seem utterly demented and screeching and screaming, screaming abuse at the band. It takes them 3 minutes to even begin to play the song. And you can hear people shouting out the words before Morrison is going to sing them, and they're throwing the song back at them, back at him, and he's realizing the, getting a sense that everything he's doing is false, everything he's doing is worthless. And here you are plunged into a kind of war between a band and its audience. The audience owns the music. It no longer belongs to the band. And they can no longer choose what to play. They can no longer choose how to play something. And you listen to this ordeal of this, I don't know how long it is, 17-minute recording, this 17-minute bootleg recording, and it just makes your skin crawl. And maybe that's what the song was designed to do all along. I don't know. But what you hear is the dilemma of someone who thinks of himself as a fine artist, as a serious artist, but doing his work in the milieu of the popular, in the milieu where the audience has as much or more power than the artist, and in, you know, plunged into the dilemma of democracy. And that is that everyone has a right to speak, and just because you're up there on the stage doesn't mean that doesn't mean you have a greater right to speak than the person who's standing at your feet and maybe is going to be able to drown you out. And that's what you hear here, and it's a staggering thing. And you listen to it and you think, how long can this go on? How long can anybody stand up to this? And the answer in this case was not so long.
I.e., age 27.
Right.
Grimm Marcus writes, in the end, the song, of course, it's so famous. I mean, in Apocalypse Now and everywhere else, everything seems tentative, uncertain, unclear. That's the source of the song's power. It's all-encompassing embrace of darkness, gloom, dread. This insistence, Marcus writes, on the uncertain, on working without a ground that takes the performance past its own corniness. This is the end. My only friend, he says, my only friend is brought into the song and then banished so the singer can contemplate the perfection of his own isolation, his own renunciations, his own beauty, his full, creamy, deep well. You could drop a coin into the pool of this voice and never hear the splash. Fred in Belmont, Massachusetts. Fred, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been a Doors fan right from the beginning. I saw them in Boston with Morrison. And I've never let go of the music. They speak to me like no other band. Their band has an element of spirituality to it. Their music is a search for truth, no matter where it lies, even in the dark side. The very name that they've taken for themselves, the Doors, you know, the doors of perception, the doors to the mind, the doors that open and bring you to the unknown. You mentioned earlier the writer that their music is an experimentation. It is, and it's an exploration into all the realms of life, even the unexplored. Beautiful.
Hey, Fred, I appreciate your call. A spiritual search, Greil? Do you go there with it?
I don't know. A search for truth, yeah, but not absolute truth. The truth of today as opposed to yesterday as opposed to tomorrow. The truth of what you're going to find when you open the door. But, you know, doors close, too. And there's a sense in a lot of their best music, and the end is one of those times when the door is closed. And you can't get out. You may not want to. And the whole world becomes reduced to one small dark room. And you sit there and the slightest change in shadows, in light, in sound becomes enormously significant. Everything is heightened. And so a lot of the music that you're hearing is made behind closed doors, not breaking through the doors to see the glorious sunlight.
You might wish. Here's a little bit of Roadhouse Blues. This is 1969, but this is from the 2006 reissue of the 70 album Morrison Hotel. Outtake here featuring Indiana blues guitarist Lonnie Mack on the bass, in addition to the Doors that helped put together this track. Took a couple of days, a lot of takes to get it right. Roadhouse Blues. House Blues. Greil Marcus is with us. His new book is The Doors. Greil, lots of listeners commenting online. Brittany in Norfolk, Virginia says, I was born in 1985, so The Doors' appeal is more than nostalgia. The Doors speak, at least for me, to a dark and beautiful rebellion. Kathleen says, I found The Doors to be romantic and, yes, erotic. Aaron in Iowa says, The Doors were anti-hippies. The reason this music is still around and still affecting younger generations, me in my 30s, she says, is because it's truthful and not idealistic. What do you say to that, Greil?
You know that song, Take It As It Comes, I keep coming back to it. It's a very conventional song in a lot of ways, and yet the fervor behind it, the commitment behind it, isn't conventional. It wasn't conventional then. That kind of strength is never conventional. It's never ordinary. And that's a hard thing to do. And people respond to that. People realize when you hear that song and somebody's saying, take it as it comes,
mm-hmm.
In this case, you believe it. You say, this person means what he's saying. Do I mean what I'm saying when I say I'm going to take things as they come? I'm not sure. You play that song again and you think, yeah, that's what it means. This is going to be rough. This is going to be difficult. But this is the way I want to live. And that's, you know, that's what we get from music. We get a dramatization of different people talking about what it means to live. There are many ways to live, and one record is gonna tell you that living in a certain way, living with care, looking over your shoulder, thinking things over, is a way to live. It's a good way to live. And someone else is going to say, not only do you put your foot down on the gas, and not only do you turn the radio up all the way and sing along at the top of your lungs, but you barrel down that freeway with your eyes closed. And that's a lot of what you can hear in The Doors.
You're such a great listener, and you know the music of this time so well. I mean, I wonder just your thoughts on what holds up best, who holds up best, and how do the Doors hold up compared to the Stones? You can hear a kind of a Stones echo in here. How do they hold up?
Well, you know, it's song to song.
Mm-hmm.
one of the things that I felt writing this book was the ultimate Doors song, the song that kind of realized everything the Doors were ever reaching for, both musically, in terms of ideas, in terms of a sense of what the world is in the Rolling Stones song, Gimme Shelter. But that song would never have happened, would never have come out the way it did if the Doors hadn't laid the ground and seeded it and harvested what came up. That had already been done when the Rolling Stones got that message.
We've just got half a minute. They still perform. Not, of course, Jim Morrison. He was gone. Did it end for you when Morrison died in Paris in 1971, the Doors, magic?
The magic and the music didn't end, but the band was over. But, you know, in a lot of ways, the band was over before that. They couldn't go on. They couldn't work with Morrison. The three guys in the band couldn't mm-hmm. work with Morrison. Morrison had another life to live, and he went off and didn't come back.
Off and not back, but back and well listened to in the pages of Greil Marcus's new book, The Doors, A Lifetime of Listening to Five Mean Years. There's an excerpt you can read at our website, onpointradio.org. Greil Marcus, it's always an honor and a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, this was great, and you have wonderful listeners.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Greil Marcus, joining us today from New York. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm.